I don't know if you can relate to this type of experience where you're in the car with your family, you're on a journey, maybe to school, or maybe you're with your partner going to a concert or a special event. And it's in those last 5 minutes before you reach your destination that the conversation shifts function from, shall we say, beautiful, casual dialogue to those rapid, quick-fire questions like, did you remember your lunchbox? Have you got your water bottle? Have you got your sports shoes? Did you remember this and this and this? Or if it's with your spouse, did you remember the concert tickets? Was I supposed to remember the concert tickets? And on it goes. When you have a deadline in front of you, it focuses your mind and you begin to drill down into the detail. And with Jesus, his Galilean ministry is now complete, and he's on his journey to his final destination, towards Jerusalem. He's already told his disciples that he's going to be rejected by the religious scholars. He's going to suffer many things. He will die. He will be resurrected. And rather than go the route around Samaria and circumnavigate it, Jesus chooses to go right through Samaria, that place that's enemy territory, where for hundreds of years blood has been spilt on this ground. Now, Matthew and Mark, the other gospel writers here, they try to get to the destination quickly with rapid, quick-fire rounds, getting you quickly over the door towards the crucifixion. But Luke is very different in his approach. He is ambling towards Jerusalem. He takes 10 chapters in Samaria. Now, that is interesting, 10 chapters. And Jesus is not in a rush. He's walking. He's talking with his friends. And what he's doing is slowly awakening his disciples to be aware of what it's like to participate in kingdom life, even when your feet are paddling through enemy territory. Because these were politically and religiously fraught times. In the next chapter, we're going to learn about that dreadful story where Pilate hears about Galileans worshipping in a temple, and he slaughters them and uses their blood and mixes it in with sacrifices. Lord, have mercy on things like that. And it's hard to talk about faith in these kind of charged climates. And you would think that Jesus would have had this strong sense of urgency that the crucifixion is coming and he needs to speak plainly words of repentance towards these Samaritan people. But he doesn't do that. These are not brimstone sermons. Instead, Jesus is peppering this walking and talking towards Jerusalem with stories about farmers and judges and coins and sheep and sons. Stories that don't really feel very religious at all. They're not brimstone sermons. They're more like those little pebbles you find in your shoe. You know they're there and they're meant to do something for you. That we're not quite walking right. We need to make adjustments. You know, sometimes we talk about the things of God as a way of getting away from our pain and the real issues in our lives. But what is going on here is God is saying, I want to show up in your ordinary, in your present circumstances. And so we get drawn into this story of a man who comes to Jesus and he says, Jesus, justice must be done. Teacher or rabbi, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. Now that seems like a very good cry for justice. The rabbis themselves stated that if someone like this comes to their door looking for a division of inheritance, then it should be granted. It's that straightforward. It only seems fair that this obligation should be fulfilled. There's this justice issue. It needs resolved. How we love our justice issues, don't we? This is the heartbeat of the Bible, the cry out against injustice. And there's nothing in this that has any tinge of the man being on anything other than the right side of the law. And yet, look at how Jesus replies. It's a gruff reply. Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter over you? Surely God is a judge, isn't he? Well, the clue here comes in that word arbiter, which means to divide up. And when you begin to think about inheritance, when you begin to think about land divisions, you begin to understand this is really sensitive soil that we're walking on here. Whether you live in the Middle East, whether you live in Ireland, whether you live in America, how land should be divided is such a sensitive issue. It gets to the heart of many of our painful stories in history. And this is a reminder, this is our story. We're in this story now. But more than that, clearly something had gone on between these brothers that had created a broken relationship. And Jesus was saying, you want me to bring this line down between you and your brother forever? Except the interesting thing here is that Jesus begins to address not just the man, but he's beginning to address everybody in the crowd. Do you want me to be the one who divides? That's not my role. I'm the reconciler. Leslie Newbegin wrote this about justice. He said, if we acknowledge the God of the Bible, we're committed to struggle for justice in society. Justice means giving to each his due. But our problem is that each of us overestimates what is due to him as compared with what is due to his neighbor. If I do not acknowledge a justice which judges the justice for which I fight, I'm not an agent of justice, but of lawless tyranny. The problem with this man, he had already decided what the outcome should be. He had already decided how much he should be getting out of this. And what he wanted Jesus to do was to simply get in line with his plan and implement it. It was a naked cry for justice. Give me my rights. It doesn't matter about family issues over here, but give me my rights. Oh yes, this seemingly innocent, naked cry for justice had some deeply mixed motives going on. Sometimes we do that. We cry out for justice, and we don't mind if it's making us look good in front of others. Jesus was not indifferent to injustice, but what he was doing here was showing there's something much bigger at stake. He was widening the picture to show there was something greater to be gained than this inheritance, but also something greater to lose too. And maybe that's why in this place called Samaria, Jesus holds us back from over-spiritualizing, over-theologizing, and using big words. Instead, he just brings us into this story, the barn builder. A story which demonstrates you can't draw up this neat equation between abundance of life and abundance of possessions as if they're two equal things. In fact, Jesus goes on to say they're at opposite ends. So Jesus says, what do you think about this man who, just for this 1 year, has a windfall, a bumper crop, and there's no room in his barns to store any of his grain. Again, there doesn't seem to be anything wrong with this. It just happens that this is a good year. Surely building a bigger barn is wise planning. But it doesn't take long to give you a sense that all is not well again with this picture. There's a self-absorption going on here. Earlier in Luke, we had that beautiful story of the Good Samaritan, of what it means to love God and love the people around you. But look at this man. Who is he talking to? Himself. He's talking to himself. There's no other people involved in this decision-making. And if you've ever built a house, you will know just how many decisions you have to make about fittings and fixtures and colors, kitchens and bathrooms. It doesn't leave room for thinking about other people. But there's an even more subtle characteristic at play here. Think about it. Why didn't the man simply ask for the loan of another neighbor's barn, even just a year? Isn't it because there's something satisfying about being in control of your decision making so that you're not dependent on other people? You see, this man wanted to be secure. He wanted to be in control, to be in charge. But the sad reality is buildings don't fix relationships. This man was talking away to himself. Don't you think he could have got good advice from his fellow farmers? In this culture, what people would have done, especially the men, would have been to sit at the city gate and for hours tease out this problem, deliberate on it, to see what shalom justice would look like, to build up community and create a place where people know they're loved and sheltered and cared for, a social capital where people can trust each other and share the land together. But here this man is not in the city gate, he's alone. And he's saying, what about my barn? What about my grain? What about my goods? Because the sad reality is this man is in prison, surrounded by these things. This is all he's got. Instead of thinking about the privilege of wealth as love to be shared, he was calculating it as power to be used. And the problem with this prison of greed is none of us ever believe we're locked inside it because it's invisible. How do you know when you've crossed that line over into greed? When does eating one more chocolate cross the line from being simply enjoying it to being greedy? When does buying a new car or a new laptop cross over the line from being something I need to something that makes me feel better about myself? After all, there are people richer than me. There's always going to be more rich people who live in bigger houses. But you see, unlike all the other vices, greed is this invisible prison that you can cover up with good intentions. Just look at how this man shapes his language. He says, I'm going to tear this down, I'm going to build this up. Tearing down, building up. Now, that's the language of prophecy. It's the language Jeremiah used when God was tearing down nations and building them up again. This rich language was being cheapened by a warped perspective. And you see, whenever a person gets stuck in addictions, often it's not really because of the love of chocolate or the love of alcohol or the love of something. It's to mask the inner pain, the pain of loneliness. And this man was using all these things around him to build up nirvana, to give him the illusion that the deep pain of emptiness was not there, the lack of self-worth was not there. He was covering it up with his building barn language. Now we're talking a language we all understand here. And there's an interesting little wordplay that goes on in this passage. Verse 16 talks about producing fruit. And that same verb, producing fruit, is the same root word which talks in verse 19 about enjoying yourself. It's the word euphoria. The man was searching for euphoria, but there was one problem. The man didn't realize he was playing with all these toys that didn't belong to him. In fact, his own body was only ever out on loan from God. God tells him, "You fool. This is the opposite of euphoria. You're the very opposite of what you think you are. Your life is empty. Your soul is empty. Your friendships, where are they? Look at what you've done." Do you ever drive yourself so hard in your workplace you lose your own sense of friendships and community? Do you ever push on thinking, "One day I'll be able to take it easier, but for now I just need to dig a little deeper"? God says, "You fool." And that's where we press pause in the story. We don't know what happens next. Does this rich farmer die that night, as God says? Or does he make an about change? We don't know. This parable doesn't yield up its secrets because it's inviting us to think about ourselves, about all the times we worry about money, all the times we worry about future planning. And whenever we get fixated on these things as if they are the narrative of our stories, then life gets thin and life gets small. And the one antidote to all these things, to greed itself, is given at the end. It says, "Learn to be rich to God." Learn to be rich to God. The God who is everything, how do you be rich to God? Well, God is simply saying, "I want you to get tied in to my life." Sometimes Jesus takes us through Samaria to realize we should be hungry for something more. In the wilderness of Lent, we discover that what we worship should be God himself and how to recover this fresh appetite for God. And the way to get connected back into God, to be rich towards God, is to pray. You know how we pray those words every week. "Lord, give us this day our daily bread." Now, many of us don't worry about where our daily bread comes from. But in this clever little phrase is hidden holiness, because it's saying that even our bread should be connected to God, because God enjoys providing for our daily needs. This story begins with division, with a broken relationship. I want you to imagine another story. How different this story would have ended if the man at the start of the story, instead of saying, "Rabbi, tell my brother to divide my inheritance with me," instead, in love, he reached out and covered the debt of his brother. That's what a true brother would have done, given up his own riches, his own security, to ensure that the relationship was restored. Aha, do you get a glimpse of a bigger picture going on here? This man wanted Jesus to step in to a petty argument, but Jesus was saying, "No, I have a greater mission. I want to take on the debt of the world. I want to take on these divisions in the world. This temple, I'm going to tear it down. But I'm going to build something so much greater, a greater kingdom." And this is the powerful, surprising way of the cross, where Jesus left the riches of heaven. For our sakes, he became poor so that we could enter into his kingdom family and know we're the beloved community of God. We become his brothers and sisters. We get the riches we never deserved. So in closing, what does this life look like for you? What does abundant life look like? As you leave to work this week, think about those around you. What does abundant life look like for them? Are they making this equation? The more abundance in possessions I have, the more abundance in life I should have. That's not the algebra of euphoria. The algebra of euphoria is being tied in to the one who gave us all things, to God himself. So pray and ask God to give you what you can't get for yourself.